seen anything like that.
I'm a very confident front runner for Caddy for 33 years, 145 wins now, and that's the best win I've ever had.
I have no idea what you have.
I don't know. How are we going to count all the shots? I can't keep track.
Fuck! God damn it.
I don't think he's pleased.
Of course, that's a particularly stupid question. It's the Irish Open. Of course, we want to play at the weekend.
You're welcome along to Golf Weekly. We are excited. It's the fourth major of the year. USPGA is underway at Quail Hollow. I'm joined here by Dave McIntyre. Hello, Dave.
Hi, Joe.
Nathan Murphy, not here.
No.
Fionn Davenport, not here. Yeah. I won't lie, friends of the pod. I suggested to Dave about just an hour ago, let's just leave this, Dave. I'm struggling to get a guest. It's not happening. Let's just put a pin in this and come back next week. And you said no.
It's a major championship week. And we need to have respect for our listeners. We need to let them know that, you know, circumstances have made it a little more difficult today, but we've come through for them. It may only be you and I, but I would suggest that is better than nothing. Some of our listeners may differ.
I'm not so sure.
It's my contention that half an hour with yourself and myself is better than zero. Plus, it's the PGA Championship.
This is true. So the good news is it won't be just you and I. I've got some good audio from Rory McIlroy, some Jordan Spieth stuff. I've got Phil and Ernie talking about their 100th major. I've got Jason Day. And your tweets then. Daniel Metcalf makes the point. He was obviously watching the WGC last week, won by Matsuyama in fine fashion. Rory obviously swinging great, lads, with the driver not least. But how many greens did he miss in Akron with the wedge is a fair enough question.
Well, I have some very interesting wedge-based stats for later.
Okay, that sounds ominous for Rory, I would say.
Very, eye-openingly ominous.
Yeah, he admitted as much himself, actually, so the stats will only back up what he said to Sky Sports after his round were. Yeah, I mean, the driving was unbelievable. I mean, it was 300-something yards every time, straight down the middle. So the big issue with the Friends of the Pod this week, Dave, is the TV coverage.
And people of the PGA Championship this week.
Ain't happy with the BBC's offering, which is poor, to say the least.
It's an embarrassment.
Yeah.
I was wondering why, at the time of the confirmation that the BBC had won the rights to the PGA Championship, they weren't really making much of a song and dance of it.
Mm.
There was very little. There was no shouting from the rooftops, we've got major championship golf back in the BBC. Yeah. We haven't had the PGA Championship in X amount of years. Isn't this wonderful? And now we know why.
Yeah.
Because it's pathetic what they're putting together. I understand that it's the state broadcaster. PGA Championship may not rank high in its list of priorities, and there aren't that many maybe golf fans they feel they're catering for. Had it been the Masters or the Open, it might have been a different story. But to have a couple of hours on the Sunday evening.
Yeah.
Now, thankfully, Air Sport viewers will be able to watch every hour, all four days, as much of the PGA Championship as they can feast themselves on. That's where I'll be watching it.
Yeah, same. Now, lots of listeners don't have Air Sport. Air Sport, we're, you know, good friends with them. They're show sponsors for Off the Ball, but lots of people don't have Air Sport. I think far more people do have Sky Sports.
Certainly Virgin Media customers don't have access to Air Sport.
Precisely, yeah.
Now, there is another way. Off the top of my head, you can watch it on social media. You can watch it on Facebook all four days.
Right.
We'll tweet it out from the Golf Weekly account. There was a very good piece done on it during the week. So there is definitely an alternative if you don't have Air Sport.
Okay.
We can watch every shot.
Well, I'll be watching an Air Sport as well, and thank God for them. But the BBC coverage is just appalling. 2 hours on the Sunday night. Begs the question, why bother even bidding for the
thing?
Why?
Exactly.
What's
the point?
Yes, it's madness. It seems the World Athletics Championships haven't helped the situation. They're showing wall-to-wall athletics, so...
It's like
the golf suffered.
A big football match and only starting the coverage after 55 minutes.
I know. It's really terrible. And a lot of people are really angry because even the BBC do red button coverage of the golf, but in Ireland that's not available to viewers. Sheelan Strain, BBC proving why they should never be allowed the rights to a major again. No preview show, not even a half hour, hashtag amateur hour. That's another point. The Wednesday before the tournament on Sky Sports for the last 2 to 3 years has been brilliant. You get very excited. They're on the range doing that show, bringing in lots of players. You learn so much about the players. Really good interviews. You get to know the course before the tournament has started. Not even a half hour preview show on the BBC.
And
terrible.
As there would be so much on Sky Sports News as well. There would be so many on-course interviews.
Yeah.
So many insights into the golf course, the tweaks to Quail Hollow,
yeah.
Previous champions in the Wells Fargo Championship. Look, I'm not sure what the PGA of America were thinking of when they decided that they were going to show Sky the door and look elsewhere. Had it rocked up on terrestrial television and we had proper coverage, well, you could see why. Yeah. Because the PGA of America are definitely keen to expand the viewership for this tournament. Yeah. This is not the way to do it.
Yeah. And the Sky Sports News point is a real one, because it is a failing of Sky Sports News. If it's not on Sky channels, it doesn't really exist, is their general approach. Like the Sky Sports News channel, it's more Sky Sports promotional news.
It is. It's case in point, the Champions League.
Yeah.
How much Champions League do you hear about on Sky Sports News? They probably have a guy in a chair like Tony Cotty when there's an English club playing in Europe, but that's about it.
Or Steve McLaren when England play.
That's
another story. So I saw at one point as well, Ken Brown, who we all like. Ken Brown has been doing some work in the States as well recently, tweeted out his excitement to be back on the Beeb with the USPGA and how much they were looking forward to it. And he tweeted shamelessly the hours of coverage. You know, here's where you'll find us, 2 hours on a Sunday. And several friends of the pod took out their guns and loaded up on Ken. This is terrible coverage, Ken, said one of our listeners. I think it was Tim. Too scared to annoy the Antiques Roadshow viewers and not show the golf hashtag joke. Now, I went back today just to find that tweet to read it out. Ken Brown had since deleted
the schedule,
the tweet. Even Ken probably looked. I'm getting a lot of abuse here. A lot of abuse. So, yeah.
Well, you see, I'd say the producers of the golf coverage in the BBC probably sent Ken an email or sent him a text. We've got the schedule confirmed. You wouldn't just send a tweet out about it, would you? Yeah. Ken probably almost absentmindedly said, yeah, no problem. Here we go. Not realising that it was a pathetic schedule of events for the PGA.
Barry Keller, how do you get the coverage of NBC Golf Channel in Ireland, lads? I need more than a weekly pod for golf nerds. Hashtag friend of the pod. Well, Air Sport is your best bet, Barry, if you can get hold of that. I presume there's maybe a way of getting an Air Sport package for the week. Maybe if you're really desperate, you might just have to order in for the month.
I'm not sure. You can always change your broadband provider today.
Yeah.
If you can do it that quickly, and you will get Air Sport for free if you're a subscriber to Air Broadband.
Okay.
So that's one way to do it.
Then there are other means, Barry.
Barry, there are other means, and as an employee of both Off the Ball and Air Sport, I shall not be telling you what they are over the airwaves. Yeah. But there are other means.
Yeah. So that's the BBC. If we suddenly sound very different, oh dear, Dave, I'm starting to wonder if this broadcast is cursed. We are suddenly in a different studio. We got kicked out.
It'll be cursed if one of the two of us fails to hit record, happened in the past, or one of the two of us believes it to be in the system when it's not.
Well, that is true.
So let's avoid those two pitfalls and keep going.
We've moved studio. So some other tweets from friends of the pod. Rock, don't know what your name is, but he has a picture of two at Golf Weekly NT friends of the pod after a round at Bethpage last Saturday, which is on my bucket list. There's a lovely feature on... Did you see the new Sky Sports show's Views on Golf? Have you seen that on Sky Sports Golf yet? It's not bad. I mean, they need to broaden the talking heads. They have like Simon Holmes and Pete Cowan and Claude Harmon and a few others. It's kind of like a two-part thing for a half hour on Sky. So for the first part of it, they'll talk about a certain player. So we're going to get people's thoughts on Bubba Watson's game or Bernhard Langer's game.
Is it live?
No. It's recorded, and it's like the same. It's Pete Cowan and Simon Holmes wearing the same clothes, so they seriously just flogged them for a day and got 20 shows.
I know what you mean.
Yeah, so they'll
it's like Lake Regale.
Yeah, they'll break down Bubba's technique. They'll break down what he's bad at, what he's good at. And in fairness, they will tell the truth. Like Pete Cowan's not afraid to say Justin Rose's putting. I saw a Rose one isn't good enough,
right?
You know, or his chipping. Pete Cowan was saying Rose, an okay chipper, just about adequate for the level he's at.
Okay.
Could be better. So that kind of good.
Yeah.
And then the second part is they talk about a certain golf course. They do a feature at the course. Bethpage Black is one of the courses. Kind of cool.
It being the first host of the PGA Championship in its new calendar date.
Oh, interesting.
2019.
Is it? Yeah.
Yeah.
Mike Davis was on talking about how they wanted to make a proper public course like Bethpage hosts US Open. So they were talking about that journey. And it seems like a pretty cool place. So
how much,
good man Rock.
I know we were just straying from the tweets. Just quickly, you've been watching the Sky Sports Golf Channel. Is it wall-to-wall golf?
Mm.
How have they managed to fill it?
A lot of Euro Pro Tour stuff. Bloody, it's hard to watch that.
Why would you?
Well, I suppose I like watching people in a golf ball, but I mean...
But then, like, just go down to the range and just stand there and watch people.
No, a bit too much Euro Pro Tour.
Do you watch the Trilby Tour as well?
I haven't been known to watch some Trilby Tour. It's the golf. It's the camera angles that make it bad as much as anything.
Well, there's one camera.
Yeah, like it is. It's some London's camcorder. I'm waiting to see like the date and the time at the bottom right corner. So, I wouldn't say it's really been a roaring success. What a terrible blow to them to lose one of the majors in their first year as Sky Sports really Golf. So, like, there's lots of how the Open was won at the moment. Anyway, Sheelan Strain, not a bad view on Saturday at Calanova Golf in La Cala, Spain.
Lovely.
If only the golf was as good at Golf Weekly NT. Hashtag 26 points, hashtag 8 3 putts.
I'd take 26 points now if you offered it to me.
Would you take 8 3 putts and the rest 2 putts?
If the 3 putts meant that I was missing out on a par or a bogey, yes, I would. If the 3 putts cost me a point on the hole, which seems to be happening more often than not, well, then it's a little different. I'm in a bad place in my game at the moment.
Are you? After going so well?
Yeah, the extraordinary improvement has plateaued and now I'm struggling to drive it straight.
Oh.
Whatever about all this talk about short game and Dave Peltz, I'm sure, you know, that stat where you lose 80-90% of your shots to par within 100 yards of the hole.
Yeah.
It doesn't really matter what you're doing with 100 yards of the hole if you're playing your second ball or you're hitting your fourth or fifth shot.
Yeah.
And if you can't drive the ball at our level of golf, you have no business.
But you're driving the ball well when we played
I was. I'm still hitting it very well, but it's going way left or right.
Okay. Well, that's not the end of the world. I mean, that's more
fixable. It is fixable. No, I'll get there. But there's a big round of me. I just can't find it right now.
Yeah. I've plateaued at 13.
Okay. But you're not working as hard at it as you were to get to 13, are you?
Yeah. I don't know. I mean, I didn't work that hard in the first
place. Are you obsessed?
I went to a lesson or two and it just made a huge difference to ball striking. What I've noticed now is I'm now at the point where I can hit the ball pretty well. It's the greens and the short game that's breaking my heart.
So you are in that position of needing to improve your short game.
Yeah, too many.
I'm not there yet.
Yeah.
Never will be.
Do you know what? It turns out it's far more fun being in the position of I'm going to sort out my driver and my iron play.
I work on your short games. There's no fun there.
Nah, it's drudgery. It is drudgery.
I'm going to head up to the range for an hour and chip.
Yeah.
No thanks. I want to blast drives.
Can I tell you? So, okay, not to diverge too much because no one wants to hear about another man's golf game in much detail. But just a small snapshot. I recognise off 13, the way I'm striking the ball with the driver and the irons, really, like, the law of diminishing returns, the way I could get to single figures would be to have a really hot short game. So I've noticed that putter has just not been great the last, like, month and a half. Really, it's so frustrating. I hit so many greens and regulation and three putt. I mean, it's really unbelievable. You know, to the point where people I play with for the first time, by the fifth or sixth hole, are saying, geez, if you held a few putts, you'd be right in this. I'm like, yeah.
Tell me about it.
Yeah. But anyway, I've recognised this pattern. And a week ago, I finished a round in Kilcock where I was playing and I did an hour on the greens. And then on a Thursday evening, I live near Luttrellstown. I went up to Luttrellstown, beautiful putting green there. I did an hour and a half on the greens and I played the next day. So that's 2.5 hours of putting practice in the space of 6 days. Never did that in my life before. I thought by the end of my hour and a half on Luttrellstown on the Thursday night, I thought, I'm rolling the ball well here. I feel like I've got a groove here. Played the next day in a comp, no improvement at all.
But see, are you working on the right things? How do you know?
I don't know.
How to fix your putter?
Noel Fox gave me, I had too much of my right hand. I was gripping the club a bit too much like an iron. So I guess like a weaker grip, weaker right hand grip with your putter. So my right hand is far more kind of lower than it was. It was more on top of the grip. So I did have Noel Fox look at it. And it made a big difference, I suppose, in terms of the stroke. It's such a mental thing. I could go out to a practice green now with you and I'd lag put everything from 40 feet, 20 feet, 30 feet beautifully and I'd hole a load of putts from 10 feet and then when I'm in a comp on a course...
Put a card in the back pocket,
Joe. Oh, I think it's actually a more of a mental thing than a stroke issue.
Well, I'm as mentally fragile as they come and go. And I can't bring my range game anywhere near the golf course. Mm. Cream and drives.
I think it's much harder to bring a range game to golf. It's just such a different discipline.
Yeah.
It's a completely different
game. There's just no pressure. You know there's another ball there to hit if you want. You don't have to worry if you slice it or sky it or it doesn't really matter.
But you're even hitting off mats. It's just it's a whole different comfort level.
Yeah, it is.
Whereas I think a practice green and a green should...
There should be no difference between a tee, though.
A tee, driving the ball, it should be
the exact same.
Yeah, you tense up a little bit. But I don't know. I just think the difference in putting shouldn't be so severe. But anyway, that's where I am in my life right now. It's zero fun. Completely plateaued. Like I'm hitting like the other day at Kilcock in the comp where I was out of the comp because of my putting. was on the 16th. I hit a 5 iron, 190 yards. Was
Jesus.
On the, yeah, it was on the green. Super shot. And
walked off with a bogey.
I was 20 feet away from the pin and walked off with a bogey. And I sort of said, like, what's the point here? Because I just hit a 5 iron, 190 yards to the green.
You get a great buzz off the 5 iron.
Oh, stunning. But see, at this point now, I was so dejected. I was like, I'm not even going to two-putt that.
An easy bogey from there.
Yeah. Anyway, sorry. Sorry for the digression. I know no one likes those conversations very much. Matsuyama, by the way, a few people pointing out that my pep talk seemed to help Matsuyama with his game. I chatted to him at the Irish Open. Did you? You heard that?
I'd heard wind of it, yes.
Yeah. So John Kelly says, not having to talk to Joe mid-round, a big help to Matsuyama's concentration levels this week. Anto Hughes, I heard the reason Matsuyama pauses at the top of his swings because he's daydreaming about Joe. And Shane Fitzy, Joe, what advice did you give Hideki? I could do with it. Hashtag friend of the pod. Look, I just pointed out one or two things in his swing playing, his weight transition, and lo and behold, Matsuyama shoots 61, wins at Akron.
And what's your Japanese like?
He speaks a bit of English now.
Okay.
I know he did his post-round interview at Akron with the translator. That's a ruse. He could do it in English.
Right.
Not a great interview, but he couldn't talk about
the Pochettino school of interviewing.
I think so. Yeah. I mean, right. I don't think he could talk about his existential crisis in English, but I think he could talk about his girlfriend.
Okay. So you can take the credit for that, particularly because he's never going to contradict that version of events.
Yeah, because he'll never hear about this. I can say that about him. Alrighty, so Quail Hollow, USPGA. We're talking about that next. So we're recording mid-Thursday evening afternoon. Rory McIlroy hasn't even gone out yet. Actually, mention of Matsuyama, just worth keeping an eye on over the next few days because, I mean, his form is unbelievable. He's had, in his last 20 starts, he's been first or second 9 times.
That's
off the charts.
Incredible run of form.
Yeah. But very interestingly, his putting is something he's still not comfortable with. And he used a mallet putter at the WGC. And he was saying this week, still not comfortable at all. And is only going to decide this morning what putter he's going to use. Far from ideal.
It doesn't speak of a major champion in waiting.
Mm. No, it doesn't.
But he's clearly holding enough putts to come out, go around at 61. Was it 61 or 62?
61.
At Akron.
Yeah.
Like, why is he arriving with so much uncertainty over his putter, given the amount of putts that he hold in Ohio?
Don't know. His ball striking just so good. Maybe he wasn't as reliant on it. He finished running up to Brooks Koepka at the US Open this year, so he has been in the mix, but he's just not feeling good about his putting. And there was one other interesting piece of analysis on the Golf Channel. They were questioning his strategy. So par fours this year, he's number one. Par fives this year, he's number two. Par threes, he's 81st. And he's an amazing iron player. He's maybe one of the best iron players in the world. And they think it's a strategical thing whereby he's going for broke on every par three.
He's aiming at flags.
Yeah. And that can lead to trouble. So that's Matsuyama. Rory then. We'll talk about Rory. So Rory obviously is Quail Hollow record is pretty sublime from when he first won on the PGA Tour back in 2010. Here were his pre-tournament thoughts, and he was just asked about the pressure almost of being so good on a course, and does he want to make a statement to the other big four?
I definitely don't want to be in the mindset this week of trying to go out and make any sort of statement or try to prove myself. I feel like I'm past that point. I've proven myself enough over the last 9 years of my career, and obviously I haven't won as much as I would have liked this year, and there's been a few components to that, you know, injury wise and you know, changing equipment and stuff. It has been a bit of a transitional year, but I feel like everything's settled. You know, my health is pretty much where it needs to be, and so I just want to go out there and play well this week. It's a golf course I've played well on before. But I'm definitely not going out there to try and prove anything to anyone. I just want to go out, play my game, and hopefully that'll be good enough.
Hey, Rory, your track record here speaks for itself. What is it about this place that just suits you?
I don't know. There's certain golf courses that you can see yourself shoot a score on. Even last week at Akron, I felt like I played okay. I drove the ball well, but you know, I feel like a top five was sort of nearly the worst I could have done. There's some golf courses you go to that it gives you that feeling, gives you that, you know, you don't really have to to have your best game and you still feel like you have a chance to win, and that's sort of how it feels here. Obviously there has been a few changes and there's a couple of holes that look a little different, but for the most part, you know, 15 of the 18 holes are pretty much the same, and I just feel good around here. I don't know what it is. It's, you know, I've shot a couple of really low scores. I've got some great memories. I think once you go back to a place where you do have great memories, all that starts to come flooding back to you, and it makes you feel good about yourself. And that's sort of, you know, how I feel around here.
So Rory, Dave, two top fives in his last two tournaments, WGC and the Open, trending in the right direction.
Yeah, there was a very good line from Lawrence Donegan. You had him on the show, was it last night? Mm-hmm. And off the ball last night. And he said, maybe we just judge Rory by unfair standards. Yeah. Had any other player been coming in on the back of two top fives in a WGC event and a major championship, which he has played in the last fortnight, we'd be thinking he's just one more step away from winning a major at the PGA Championship. And that's probably right. Like, a guy with his pedigree, former world number one, he's won this tournament twice already. He's won around Quail Hollow a couple of times as well. And he's had two top five finishes in elite events. You would think the next step is for him to go on and win, or at least finish in the top three.
Yeah.
And maybe there's a lot of truth in that. But it's just such a good field, and it is a major. There was a reason he didn't win in any of the previous last 2 weeks. He got himself right into the mix at Firestone. He picked up three shots on his front nine and he was right there.
Yeah.
And yet it just was frittered away and he never really got into contention down the stretch.
The driving obviously has been brilliant. So you mentioned the wedge play.
Yeah, it's pretty grim.
Okay.
In Firestone, he had 35 approach shots from inside 125 yards. Guess what he played those holes in? What score?
35 from inside 125. God, you'd like to think. How many holes?
35. You're thinking any pro worth their salt is playing that in 17 or 18 under par.
10 under.
4 under he played them in, which is quite incredible. From 125 to 150 yards, if he had played enough events on the PGA Tour this year to qualify for this ranking, he would be dead last.
Wow.
Dead last. So if he doesn't improve his wedges this week, he's not going to win anything, particularly if he doesn't have one of those magical weeks with the putter, which you wouldn't expect him to have.
Yeah.
So his wedge game is more important to him than it would be a Jordan Spieth, because he's not going to hold the same share of putts from 8 to 15 feet as Jordan Spieth will.
Yeah.
McIlroy needs, when he gives himself a chance, it needs to be a real chance.
My recent observations on McIlroy over the last 3 months are that his chipping game is in great shape. His bunker play, we never, ever, ever talk about McIlroy's bunker play. From Port Stewart on, as badly as that went, at the Scottish Open, the Open, McIlroy out of bunkers, greenside bunkers, is outrageous. He's outrageously good.
Is it not just taken as a given, though, nowadays?
I know,
the quality of the bunkers and the quality of the wedges these lads use in the sand and the quality of the greens.
Yeah.
That you really should be getting up and down. Anything inside a 10-yard bunker shot, I know it gets progressively more difficult the more green you have to carry and the more of the bunk you have to carry.
Yeah.
I don't really read too much into someone's sand saves, because it's such a basic part of the game at that level.
I'll accept that. But then I suppose in the context of a discussion about his wedge play from 125 yards, where I guess you can take nothing for granted, his bunker play is great. Do you know, like, when I watch him, and this has been a thing for the last number of years, and actually if I ever get to sit down with him for like a half hour or 45 minutes, I'm going to put it to him, because it's just been a long-held theory I'm sure of now. Whenever, and I literally mean whenever, I watch McIlroy hit an iron shot and he does a controlled sawn-off finish and just holds the finish halfway
up. A punchier shot.
More of a punchier shot, exactly. He always hits an unbelievably good shot. Anytime I see McIlroy hit a shot, holds the finish low, punchier shot, I always think, oh, he's on here. And invariably, camera cuts to green and ball is somewhere within the pin.
Yeah.
And it's like, and it's when he does this, I mean, it's gorgeous, the full flow, and, you know, the club finishes wrapped around his neck, full release. That's sometimes when he misses the green by 30 feet and you don't know what the hell's happened, and he doesn't either.
Yeah.
I just wonder, I'd love to get a gun to his head and say,
even why don't you hit more irons like that?
Even though you're not going to like this, you're going to have to go three-quarter swing
around
here.
It's not as aesthetically beautiful.
Yeah.
Well, I'm sure there are circumstances in which he's forced to hit that kind of a shot, where he's between clubs, for example, or maybe the wind is up a little, so he doesn't necessarily want to flight it as high as he normally does, because very few golfers hit the ball as high into the air as he does. or you want to control the spin a bit more, because if obviously if you're not coming from underneath the ball as to the same degree, you don't have to worry about the spin just as much. It's an interesting observation.
Well, I'm just saying from 165 yards in, there's no reason why he would have to go full flush at it.
Mm.
He could do that punchy finish. I'm just sowing that seed. Just watch the next few days golf, and any time he does that sawn off finish, you can, when the ball's in the air, I'll bet you £1 million it's within 10 feet.
There was a poser I wanted to put to you on Rory.
Okay.
And I'd love our listeners to get in touch on at Golf Weekly NT.
Yeah.
If he wins this week, it's his third PGA Championship, right?
Mm-hmm.
60% of his majors will be Wanamaker trophies. Say he gets to 7. We've always talked about 8 for some reason. I don't know why is 8 the number when McIlroy is concerned and majors, but it would obviously put him a couple ahead of Faldo. But he's always said at the very least he wants to be the most successful European golfer in major championship history. So he needs 7 to do that.
Yeah.
Say, for example, he gets to 7 and 4 or 5 of those are PGA Championships.
Yeah.
Do you still, in your mind, have him ahead of Faldo as the most successful European ever?
No.
So numerically, he's on top. But 5 of them are PGA Championships.
Yeah.
They're not 3 Green Jackets or 3 Claret Jugs.
How many Wanamakers does it take to... How many Wanamakers would you have to win for you? Or what's a Green Jacket worth? 2 Wanamakers. Maybe 2.5 Wanamakers.
I don't know.
Sean McKeel, Rich Beam. Something funny about the USPGA.
Not anymore.
I appreciate that. Lawrence Dunning made that point. The recent champions are good.
There are, like, look, you can throw in Ben Curtis and Todd Hamilton into this argument if you want.
Okay, fair enough. But it's still the
Fuzzy Zeller and Trevor Immelman.
I won't hear a bad word against Fuzzy.
Like there have been, you know, unheralded champions in all 4 majors.
Okay, fair enough. But okay.
The Sean McKeel...
I retract that. That was so much
of an outlier.
I take it back.
Gave the PGA Championship a real dent.
No,
just
I take
because
it back.
He won it.
I take it back. But Faldo, 3 Green Jackets, 3 Opens. That is, I mean,
it's better than 1 Open, a US Open, and 5 Wanamakers. It definitely is. Like,
miles ahead.
Yeah. But you'd still be ranked as the most successful major champion ever to come from European.
In answer to your poser question, I think there would be an asterisk there. I think when people talked about the greatest European golfer, and if you're going on titles alone, I think if you were discussing McIlroy and Faldo, you could really make such a strong argument that Faldo's achievement is greater. Yeah,
you would. I'd call it a poser. It's not really arguable, really.
What if he won 8 Wanamakers? and his US Open, if you're in
double digits. That's a different discussion.
Okay, 7 Wanamakers, 1 US
you
Open.
You still won 9 majors. Like, you're in the elitist
sure,
of elite
look, you've
company.
Beaten, you've
like, then
Palmer.
You're going past Palmer, yeah. Tom Watson, all these guys.
But I'm asking you again. 7 Wanamakers, a US Open, and an Open Championship. Or Faldo's 3-3. 7 Wanamakers. You'd almost be embarrassed.
I would say that he would... He would lose 3 of his majors and take Faldo's 3-3, mainly so that he can play the Masters for the rest of his career.
Well, there's that, yeah. And would have done the Grand Slam.
You know what it reminds me of?
Uh-huh.
When UEFA, they decide who wins the Golden Boot. And certain leagues, you only get like a percentage of the goal.
Yeah.
So like Henrik Larsson had to score like 50 goals in a season for Celtic to beat Emilio Butragueño playing for Real Madrid or whatever. Maybe they're the wrong generations, but you know what I mean.
Yeah.
So, I mean, if the ratio of Masters to PGA Championships, it's maybe 0.8%.
Yeah, and that's not even a fair analogy because you're still beating the same strength of field in the USPGA, whereas Henrik Larsson is scoring 8 goals against Hearts.
So what is the argument then? Like,
I don't know.
It's still a major. It's still extremely difficult to win.
Tradition, the quality of the course maybe. I don't know.
High quality golf.
I know. I don't even fully believe in that.
Yeah. Up until now, it has carried a lot of pressure going into it because it's your last chance if you haven't had a great season to win a major.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's an interesting one. It's just when I thought about him winning this week, and suddenly I'm thinking 5 major championships. That's incredible. But 3 of them are PGAs.
Yeah, it's an interesting point. So Jordan Spieth can complete the career Grand Slam age 24. Now, this course.
doesn't seem to set up great from. You need, this is a course, one of the reasons McIlroy does well here is this is a course which is just outright long. You need to launch the ball a long, long, long way here, and that is not Jordan Spieth's strong suit. And
particularly if it's soft, as we were hearing it might be this week, so the ball isn't going to run as much.
Yeah. So that offsets some of his genius, the non-measurable genius of Spieth to kind of wangle his way out of tricky situations. This is just a more straightforward course in some ways. That said, he has belief, and it was something Brandel Chamblee told a nice story about Jordan Spieth on the Golf Channel in the last few days. He was talking about Spieth's belief, which has been around for a long time.
There is no way to measure belief, right? You got to believe this is the greatest. These are great athletes. Everybody here has belief. But I don't think that anybody has the type of belief that Jordan Spieth has in himself. Some of the players that he played with in junior golf, I know their parents. They're good friends of mine. And one of them said that he had more belief than anybody out there. And it was almost unjustified because he'd be on the range scrapping around. People would stop and listen to Emiliano Grillo hit golf balls. But Jordan Spieth would annihilate him in the golf tournament. And so, you know, when you have great belief in yourself, you can do things that you never would believe you could do. Federer said as much this year. Nobody would have guessed that at 35 he could win two slams, not even him at 35. But he said exactly that this year. He said, when you have belief, you never know. You can do things you never believed were possible.
There you are, Brandel Chamblee. Nice story about Spieth trashing the more talented youngsters in his day. The latest I saw was that Spieth was plus one through 10. It's not a phenomenal start, but equally it's not out of the tournament start either.
I'd say he won a lot of tournaments at underage level in the main to his opponents just completely underestimating him.
It reminded me of Padraig Harrington as a youth, what Chamblee was saying there. Not really a guy to catch your eye in the range.
I don't have to worry about him.
Yeah, and then would just break your heart with a 50-footer or up and down or something stupid.
When you think you have him, he nailed you.
Yeah. He's the one player, I mean, McIlroy was asked about the pressure of completing a Grand Slam, and he was sort of saying, you know, he kind of thinks it won't be as big a deal for Spieth here, because he was saying in his own case he won at Valhalla and, man, had a long time to think about Augusta, whereas Spieth has almost slingshotted into this. He hasn't had too much time to think about it. His form is good. It's easier, obviously, to maintain your form across the last 2-3 weeks as opposed to your form at Valhalla is almost irrelevant to your form come April time at Augusta. So
if you're one leg short of the Grand Slam, this is the leg you want to be short of.
Yeah.
Because you can play your way into the PGA Championship, but you've got so much time and so many big tournaments to build up some form. The PGA Championship to Masters analogy is a very good one, because like I remember when Harrington won in 2008, was at Hazeltine, and he had won three majors in 2 years.
Yeah.
And he was arguably the best golfer in the world at that very moment when he beat Garcia that night. And he said, I wish the Masters was next week.
Yeah.
And by the time he got to the 2009 Masters, his game was gone.
Mm. Yeah. So Spieth, it's hard to see him do it. It seems the course is just not helping him in any way. Mm. And also, interestingly, the course, they've changed from Poana to Bermuda grass. And Padraig Harrington was talking about this. I won't blind everyone with the science, but effectively, the really simple line you could make is that the Bermuda grass is easier to put on. And Lawrence Donegan the other night was making the point that actually the more treacherous and difficult the greens are, the more that Spieth's genius on the greens is highlighted. The trickier the greens, the more that Spieth's genius is, it's more valuable. Yeah. It sets him apart from the others.
The easier the greens, the higher quality of the greens, it's negated a bit then.
Yeah. So McIlroy will find these greens easier than Poana greens. And that levels the field a little bit for Spieth. So that's another advantage of his sort of gone. Jason Day was talking. He is obviously a former USPGA champion, won by a landslide when he was at the peak of his powers at Whistling Straits a couple of years ago. So Day was asked to sum up his season thus far.
First word that comes to my mind is disappointment of not because of the actual level of play. It's just that I just didn't give myself a shot to play well. And I'm not giving my mum an excuse or anything like that. It's just that everything that I do out in the golf course is solely because of me and what I do off the golf course as well. But if I had to give it another word, it's improving. I'm improving each and every day now. And actually, I'm hungry again. And I'm looking forward to trying to beat these guys here in a bit, but I'm very motivated right now. Like I want to win again, so I'm excited about that.
The other thing about Day is his back did not look very flexible at the WGC.
He's got big problems.
Yeah,
it's been such a disappointing year. Obviously, there's been issues off the golf course as well with his mum, and I certainly wouldn't. I doubt he's on anyone's tipping list for this week.
No.
It's been really disappointing because we got into the 2017 season and we thought McIlroy will return to his dizzy heights. We know Spieth is going to be capable of winning big things. Dustin Johnson has just won his first major. The year before, Jason Day has won his first major. And outside of Spieth, nobody has done anything.
Mm.
Since the day that Dustin Johnson fell down the stairs, the majors have been dull.
Yeah.
Now, Spieth kind of brought us back a bit with that brilliant performance in the back nine at Birkdale. But he was up against Kuchar. No disrespect to Matt Kuchar, but he's boring.
Yeah.
And like, I was incredible, it was incredible watching Spieth on the Sunday, but with all the stuff around the drop and everything. But if he'd been up against McIlroy, it would have been absolutely gripping.
Yeah. Some other players just to mention. Danny Willett has split with his caddy a couple of months ago. He's now split with his coach. Danny Willett's gone to Sean Foley.
Okay.
To try and sort out his game. Sergio was doing his press conference and was basically saying his game is no good at the moment. He's just not striking the ball well, so we can kind of write Sergio off this week.
He's just enjoying being a major champion and a newly married man. And he's walking around with absolutely no pressure on his shoulders. In fact, this is the kind of week that maybe he will just come up with something, something.
Something could click, because even Matsuyama on the Sunday at the WGC was saying he had one of the worst warm-ups of his life. On the first tee then, he came over the top of the ball and hooked it left and then suddenly realised why he had done that, and the next 17 holes were bliss. Just what a bizarre game. Somebody who does have pressure on his shoulders is Shane Lowry. So Shane Lowry hasn't managed a top 10 finish on the US Tour once this season. So no top 10 finish all season. He started out the world rankings this year 43rd. He's now dropped to 83rd. And as things stand, he won't make the FedEx Cup playoffs unless he does something remarkable this week or effectively wins the Wyndham Championship next week, which is the last tournament of the US Tour's regular season. And I never thought actually Shane Lowry would end up doing this. He was always such a homebird, always talked about how he was never going to leave Ireland. Like, I could play a clip of him from even just 18 months ago saying that. But Palm Beach Gardens in Florida is where Shane Lowry and his wife and new daughter are headed for. They're certainly going to do January to June there, he says, of the last while. It's hard. It's been very hard for me these last few years, and I feel like the travel has been my downfall, to be honest. It's been too hard for me. It's been too hard to keep my world ranking, and you end up not being in all the big tournaments. Like, not playing in Akron last week was tough, especially after winning the event in 2015. I have plans to move to America for a few months next year. I'm going to concentrate full time on the PGA Tour and see what happens after that. I've just been traveling too much. I've not seen enough of the girls, and to have them with me most of the time will be nice. And he's kind of talking about just being sick of being jet lagged as much as anything. Prior to flying in to Quail Hollow this week, which was his eighth West Bend flight of the year across the Atlantic, Lowry met up with his psychologist, Jerry Hussey, for a day-long session, which he said he's hoping will help him this week and for the rest of the season, try and get back into the world's top 50. So it's kind of like, you don't want to panic, but this is a fairly extended slump for Lowry, bar one or two highlights, US Opens and bits and pieces. It's been a while, really, since he was consistently contending.
Yeah, the Bridgestone seems a long time ago. Well, it's over 2 years now, but it's a big move, it's a bold move, it's a brave move.
Such a homebird, has his family who sees a lot, his friends he sees a lot, so he's leaving all that behind. But I mean, maybe
it may focus the mind. He might find he's getting more practice in as well, which will obviously help his game. He might feel that, well, you know, I've got rid of the jet lag and I feel a bit more settled. That's helped my game. But almost unbeknownst to himself, the extra practice he's putting in is clearly going to help his game.
Yeah.
And it'll be a weight off his shoulders. It's probably something he's been mulling over for quite some time.
It's a nice part of the world.
His daughter's obviously very young, so it's probably the right time. It won't necessarily involve any upheaval for her.
She should be okay psychologically.
I think she, exactly. And look, why not? See how it goes. Guys like Lee Westwood have tried it in the past. It hasn't worked out for them. They've moved back home.
Yeah.
Other people have tried it and it's worked out great. The likes of Justin Rose, for example. So I hope it works out for him.
Yeah, absolutely. So he's pretty much working off his exemption, his WGC exemption next year. Like, when you think about it, Padraig Harrington is the outlier. he's basically the only Irish golfer in the kind of real modern last 15, 20 years who has stayed. Like McGinley based himself in London, just made sense from a travel point of view for the European Tour. McIlroy's gone to Florida. G-Mac's gone to Florida. Darren Clarke moved away for most of his career and moved back very recently.
He was living in Sunningdale, wasn't he?
Yeah, around McGinley territory, and moved back for family reasons as much as anything because, you know, he's got kids. And,
well, you see, it clearly worked for Harrington.
Yeah.
You know, it hasn't worked for Lowry, so he's had to do this. Mm. I wonder if Harrington hadn't been getting the results he had been anticipating, maybe he could have ended up in this boat as well.
Yeah.
But when Harrington was winning regularly once a year, then obviously became a bit more prolific, there was no need for a change.
Yeah.
Plus, at the absolute peak of his career, the focus wasn't as heavily on the PGA Tour as it is now. Now it's just, they're worlds apart.
Yeah.
Where 10 years ago, when Harrington won his first major, clearly there was a gulf in terms of the prize money and everything and the prestige, but it wasn't as pronounced as it is right now.
Yeah. So that's a shame. Hopefully it goes well this week. Phil and Ernie, we should mention. It's never really something I thought too much about, the 100 Majors Club, but when you see the list of people who've played 100 majors, then you suddenly realise it's a pretty special club. Jack Nicklaus, 164, is the most majors played by any player in history. Gary Player played in 150. Tom Watson, 145. I mean, geez, and how many senior majors for Watson?
Yeah.
Arnold Palmer.
They're not, seniors aren't included here,
no,
surely. Yeah.
No. Arnold Palmer, 142. Raymond Floyd, 127. Sam Snead, I was surprised at, given his longevity, only 119. Ben Crenshaw, 118. Gene Saracen, 112. Tom Kite, 109. Mark O'Meara, 109. Bernhard Langer, 105. Nick Faldo scrapes in at 100 even. And that's it. History of the game. Really not that many players. So Ernie and Phil are playing in their 100th major. They first played each other 33 years ago. The picture is doing the rounds. It's quite hilarious if you see them. You can recognise them both straight away. It's kind of striking. So they first played each other as 14-year-olds in a championship in California. And they did, it was quite nice. They did a press conference together yesterday and Phil was remembering that tournament.
It started in a very nice, sunny, beautiful place in San Diego. And, you know, we're still going here quite a few years.
I remember that final round. I remember a shot you hit on that final round on number three. It was a par five, and you had it about 20 yards short of the green, 30 yards short of the green, and you hit this little skipping, spinning wedge shot that checked up about a foot from the hole, and that's when I knew you were going to be a good player because I hadn't seen anybody else at 14 hit that shot, and you went on to win that day, beat me and the rest of the field, and it's amazing that you know, we've played together and against each other for so many years. It's it doesn't seem that long ago from those days, but it sure looks a long time ago.
So there they are, Phil and Ernie. Both would have won a lot more, but for Tiger Woods. Phil is more in the press conference. He was saying, look, I think Tiger's helped my career because Tiger got me focusing on fitness, and I wouldn't have necessarily done that if Tiger hadn't come along, so I wouldn't have been winning the Open in 2013 at my age. So I think I've won more because of Tiger.
I don't subscribe to the theory that it's a throwaway remark that you've made there, that he would have won a lot more only for Tiger. How many times was he actually beaten by Tiger? Not many.
Fair point.
Not many. When I think of Phil losing majors, I think of Payne Stewart in 1999 at the US Open. I think of David Toms in 2001 at the PGA Championship. I think of Henrik Stenson in the Open Championship last year, was it?
Yeah.
I don't think of him being pipped by Tiger on the 18th at Augusta.
Okay, fair point. Ernie Els, I'll argue with you though. I'll accept your point on Phil, maybe not. I think Woods almost exerted a kind of psychological trauma on Els, because if you watch Els's Open Championship tape or program, like, he wins these majors early on, US Opens, and he thinks, man, I'm the best player in the world. And he literally says, then Tiger came along. And he pinpoints a number of occasions where they went head-to-head in various points. And Tiger, particularly in 2001, just destroyed him.
Mm.
And it seemed to really damage him. Now, I know Els obviously had a son who was diagnosed with autism around that time, and that definitely affected him. But he does talk about, like, how crushing it was. You know, the US Open in 2000, where Els finishes second by about 16 or 17 shots. And he kind of admitted Woods got in his head a little bit. And he's kind of feeling a bit hopeless about the whole thing. I think, well, he said in his press conference this week that he doesn't really like to talk too much about Woods or give Woods too much credit. Like, there was a real kind of
A bitterness there.
Sort of. A sense of, ugh, trust me to come up against the guy who played the greatest golf we've ever seen when I was at my peak. Yeah. So I think Els actually does feel that Woods has robbed him of a little bit of history in the game, of standing in the game. See, Phil's won five majors. Maybe it's a bit easier.
Yeah, I find that kind of sad. Like, Els has won four. And, like, when did that mental fragility begin to manifest itself, I wonder? Because in 94 and 97, when he was staring down Colin Montgomery at the US Open,
yeah,
like, he was a machine.
Yeah.
You know, he was robotically good.
Mm.
And he had this, like, gorgeously smooth swing. And you're thinking, this guy can win as many majors as he wants.
And he thought the same. He said in his Open thing, he said... He really thought he had 10 in his head. Thought he was going to win 10 majors.
And it was really only 6 years after Els won his first majors that Tiger hit his peak.
Mm-hmm.
Because like Tiger was winning them in ones. Like he won once in 97, didn't win again until Medina 2 years later. And at that stage, Els had a whole heap of opportunities to be winning major championships.
Funny, he talked about certain events. Like they played head-to-head in a couple of different times, like even exhibition matches. And it seemed like seeing Woods close up dented his sense of entitlement and his confidence. I don't want to misquote him, but he did talk about sort of Jordan Spieth-esque, Tiger Woods holding these ridiculous putts. You know, when Els was thinking, I can't play any better than this. And he's just conjuring up these putts that almost aren't fair. Like, how is he doing this? Like, well, I can't. I'm playing outrageously good golf, and Woods is like a magician. Like,
it must destroy
yourself.
What am
I doing here? Yeah, it's killer.
Like, you'd think would have been guys like, I mean, I'm sure for a portion of his career, Andy Murray felt that way.
Yeah.
You know, I can't play any better, but I'm up against these like three of the greats in the history of the game. I'm sure Tim Henman, although not on Els' level in that he never actually got to win a major, probably was thinking, right, I've seen Sampras off now.
Yeah.
Things will get better for me here. And then the greatest player of all time comes along, starts moving to his peak. But it's very defeatist talk from Ernie Els, but maybe it's wonderfully honest as well.
Yeah.
There are very few golfers that would openly discuss their inner feelings like he has here.
Mm. Yeah, so that's pretty much our USPGA take.
Well, the move on the calendar move, what are your thoughts on it? I know it had been coming up, so we did mention it on the pod before. Like, what will it do to improve the prestige of the tournament?
I think it will help. There'll be more attention. So it's going to go into May.
Into May. So you'll have a major for four consecutive months, and then the players in March, so you'll have one massive tournament in five consecutive months.
I think it'll make it feel like such more like a central part of the story of the season. Whereas it almost, it kind of gets bookends and then it's just quickly forgotten and the golf season almost wraps up. I think one of the reasons it feels like the poor relation is it comes last. Like you could imagine it even came first and the build up to it, the anticipation. Yeah. Whereas when you've had three majors in quick succession, invariably you're not going to be as excited about the fourth. It's just human nature.
Well, the quick succession point is a valid one. It's too close to the Open.
Yes.
And it's a week after a World Golf Championship.
Yeah.
I don't think that helps at all. And last year, for example, it just seemed to be squeezed almost into submission because you had to throw the Olympic Games in as well.
Yeah.
And there was a Ryder Cup. So the PGA Championship just seemed to be forgotten about it. And like Jimmy Walker has been forgotten by an awful lot of people, despite how well he played down the stretch in that tournament. So I think it'll definitely help. It also means the FedEx Cup playoffs are going to move up the schedule as well. So it'll no longer be competing against opening weekend of the NFL and the college football.
Completely.
So that will get more people watching golf in the States, you would hope. One move that does kind of stick out for me is that the BMW PGA Championship will move to September now.
Yeah.
Who's going to play in it in September?
If the prize fund is $7 million.
Does that really matter to the likes of McIlroy and Justin Rose and Lee Westwood and these fellas?
It's a fair question. You never really know. There's all on.
If it's in September, will the FedEx Cup be done by then?
Yeah.
Okay, so it's not going to clash with the playoffs?
No. There are always unintended consequences with these things that nobody really foresees. If you didn't see the news or hear the news, I'm sure you have really at this stage. But so from 2019, the players will start in
March.
March, yes. Yeah. So it will go the players, then April the Masters, then the USPGA in May, then the US Open in June, and the British Open in July. So basically, in those consecutive months, once a month, you're going to have one of those huge tournaments. And that's the thought process. The Olympic Games kind of in 2016. That experience was part of the decision making.
It opens the roster as well in terms of courses that the PGA Championship can be played on, because you get to mid-August, you can't really play in Florida or Texas, Louisiana, places like that. So there will be a far more courses that will be possible for the PGA Championship to be played on in May. So you can go down to those places more southern, whereas really northern USA is all the only place you can play in August, really.
I saw various interpretations. I think on the PGA Tour, I think there's no doubt it's better, and it's a stronger core season for sure. As for the European Tour, I saw you and Murray in The Guardian almost making the argument, look, the European Tour is barely consulted here. It really is not a player, and it doesn't help the Rolex series. But then Philip Reid was sort of saying in the Irish Times it actually could help. You know, he said pushing the players forward to March had little to do with the European Tour, but it actually means the Rolex series and the Race to Dubai finale could be strengthened with more American players tempted to extend their seasons in Europe. So we'll have to see how it all plays out. I mean, it's kind of hard to know. Will they reach August and just be wrecked, finish the FedEx and say, I'm done with golf? Or will they sort of think, oh yeah, no, now we swing into Europe. All the big boys want to keep going and they swing into Europe and they make September a very lucrative month in European golf.
So you have the BMW PGA Championship, which will obviously have a major bearing on the final standings for the Race to Dubai rankings.
Yeah.
So a lot of guys will feel they can turn their seasons around with a couple of big finishes at the end.
I don't know what it does to the heart of the Rolex series across the summer. Like, I don't know what it does to the Irish Open. So I hadn't really given it too much thought. We'll have to see.
The importance in the calendar of the Irish Open is its proximity to the Open.
Yeah.
And that won't change.
Yeah.
Hope in the next few years it'll actually get even closer to the Open. So I'm not sure it'll have a huge effect on that. It may have an effect on the French Open, for example. But look, we'll just have to see over the years how it goes. The biggest change will be how interesting the change in the prestige of the PGA Championship is.
Yeah.
Where will it be in 10 years?
Yeah.
I'm not going to say it's ever going to move above the US Open or the Open Championship in terms of prestige or the Masters, but it might get a bit closer to them.
So you're saying in a few years' time, Rory McIlroy will have four Wanamakers and his other two majors.
That'll change.
And we'll be saying that trashes Faldo's 3-3. Yeah. So we're pretty much done. I'm just looking here. The BBC in total will show 365 minutes of the entire tournament. It's outrageous. Absolutely crazy. 365 minutes.
6 hours.
Today being Thursday, they'll have 55 minutes of coverage on BBC Two. 11:20 to 12:15 a.m. 55 minutes tonight of a major.
Don't bother. Don't bother, lads.
On Friday, they'll only have 70 minutes. On Saturday, they'll go from 10:30. And then on the Sunday, as we've said already, 2 hours, 15 minutes of golf. The coverage on Sunday starts at 10 p.m. For shame.
What if there's a playoff? Are they just going to shut down?
Sorry, folks. Yeah. We'll show it next week.
Air Sport is where you need to be, or we mentioned it earlier, we couldn't quite think of the website, but you've dug it up.
Yeah, you mentioned this piece. So on the 42, they point out, if you want to watch it on Facebook, and it seems, so this is just pretty cool, it seems like this will be free.
Yeah.
And if you've Chromecast.
Just Chromecast it or stream it in some way.
If you don't have Chromecast, it's really worth getting. It's just effectively, bar your Sky app, but basically every other TV app or Facebook or YouTube. Pretty much everything, any video you'd watch. Chromecast costs about £30. You stick it into the back of your TV and you can just hit
Sync it with your Wi-Fi and just play whatever's on your phone on your TV.
Yeah, straight away. Netflix, fantastic for it. It's really brilliant. So, I mean, that might be a cheaper way if you really want to watch the coverage, go out and get a Chromecast and it'll do you. I mean, it's worth getting anyway. And then you can watch the next 4 days. If you go to Give Me Sport on Facebook, or there's a 42 article, or I'm sure if you just Google Give Me Sport Facebook, it'll bring it up for you. And they will broadcast from 6 o'clock on days 1 and 2 and 7 p.m. Saturday and Sunday. You get the full
extent of coverage, which is what the BBC should be doing.
Yeah. There you go. Okay, we're pretty much done. So we'll have a full review of the USPGA next week. Thanks, Dave.
Thank you. All my exes wear Rolexes, but I reside right here.